Welcome to Westerns with Dad. This is Matt.
And this is Dad.
And on this special Halloween October episode of Westerns with Dad, we will be talking about High Plains Drifter from Clint Eastwood. This is one of his first American films, or not American, but one of his first... It is the first film he directed that was a Western. He did Play Misty.
Second film overall.
Yeah, uh-huh.
That's right.
We were incorrect in our Outlaw Josie Wales episode about that fact, but yes, High Plains Drifter is indeed the first Western he directed by himself, and it is made in 1973, and it's just great. It's just a
good
just
movie.
A terrific movie. Yeah,
good movie.
I do want to make one note before we begin talking about this movie, Internist. The street I live on is getting torn up right now by construction equipment. They're installing pipes. We've been losing water periodically all week. And we tried to find a time when there wouldn't be jackhammers or things moving around. And I think we may have... you know what? It could be worse than what you're going to hear. But there is a chance that you will hear construction equipment periodically through this podcast. We will do our best to remove that in editing, but you never know. So sorry about that in advance. But High Plains Drifter is great. This is a fantastic
good entry into Halloween Westerns.
Yeah. I mean, I'd seen this before, but I think even more so than I originally thought. This is a scary Western. This is a or at least a. A creepy Halloween-themed Western. Really not scary, but like...
supernatural.
It's supernatural. I believe it's totally supernatural, and I think that that's all, the only thing you can believe at the end of this. And, of course, this is... this movie exists, you know, right at the beginning of his career, is just when he was starting to kind of really have clout in Hollywood and, you know, really sow his oats as a director. And,
especially after the success of Play Misty for Me.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Like that kind of was a proof of concept, if you will, Clint Eastwood. Yeah. It's an interesting movie. You've seen that, right? It's kind of like Misery. Yeah. he's like
movie.
A disc jockey, and then he's got like a fan who's like chasing him or something like that.
Stalking him, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. On the lurid action thriller side of the Clint Eastwood divide. It's a good movie. This is a better one. This is a really good one. This clearly is drawing from his time with Leone. Like, this is this character that he plays, never named but known as the Stranger, is it's basically a riff on The Man with No Name from that trilogy, the Leone trilogy of films, except he wouldn't be the good. In this version, this is a version that kind of imagines him as a much less heroic character and more of a force of nature.
Somebody said that he represented all three of them: the good, the bad, and the ugly.
That's interesting. That's kind of fun. That's
I mean, he's good in one respect, but that we'll talk about, I'm sure, but. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he's not a squeaky clean cowboy hero, that's for sure.
Uh-huh. He's possibly a demon. He might be a demon. he might literally be a demon from hell. But he is acting as a hammer of retribution in this film. He is a real Old Testament character. I mean, this is a he reminded me a little of the have you read Blood Meridian?
Nope.
Cormac McCarthy novel. It's a character named the Judge who he's real creepy kind of guy who may or may not be sort of a supernatural force. It's a complicated character, this is a really really fantastic idea, I think, which is he takes that iconic gunslinger character he played and says, well, what if he wasn't so good? What if he had some real darkness to him? Like all those sort of passive aggressive little pranks that he plays, or things like that. What if those had a darker edge to it? And
darker, because he was a dark character to a certain extent in the Sergio Leone movies too.
Yeah, he was an anti-hero. Yeah. I wouldn't call this an anti-hero.
No.
I wouldn't call it a villain either, though. I mean, it's interesting. He's the protagonist, but he sits above this so much. Like, you're not worried that anything's going to happen to Clint Eastwood in this movie. At no point are you concerned for him. Like he could definitely just get shot in the chest and keep walking, is the impression I got. Because he's not human, or at least maybe not a human. Certainly doesn't feel like one.
He's more like an avenging angel.
Yes. Uh-huh. Sort of. But not wholly. Not in a...
Not an angel. Avenging angel of death.
A revenant. An angel of death. That is a good way of looking at it. Or one of the horsemen of the apocalypse or something. clearly this is a weird one. Do you have any memories of originally seeing High Plains Drifter, Dad?
I thought about a lot of the same stuff that we're talking about now. But I dismissed a lot of it, and we'll talk about this when we talk about the end of the movie. But I remember trying to read into it as. Trying to accept it as a simple Western.
Oh, no.
You know, kind of an anti-hero, right, who's sent to avenge the death of the marshal.
It definitely has the form of that. It has the, it has the iconography of a traditional Western. Or at least, a 70s style Western. It looks certainly a lot grungier than John Wayne's West looked.
Speaking of John Wayne sent him an angry email or letter on this. He said it was just way too harsh.
He tended to do that, didn't he? John Wayne didn't like your Western, he would let you know.
Protected the genre.
It wouldn't work with a John Wayne. This is not his world,
Right.
This is Clint Eastwood's Western, and I've come to think of them as we've done this podcast as sort of dual kind of linchpins, on the opposite side of what a Western is, and they sort of attract. Things kind of get pulled between the two of them. I would say, and there's space on the either side beyond either of them too. But for the most part, those are those guys represent. The two halves of what a Western is to me.
That's interesting. That's a good way of looking at it, I think. Because stars like Jimmy Stewart fall somewhere in between.
Mm-hmm. He's definitely on the John Wayne side.
Well, he's on the John Wayne side, but he's not always, the squeaky clean good guy.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
He has a past occasionally, or he's, like in The Naked Spur, he was out to get this guy.
And he was like in Man from Laramie. He's out to get revenge.
Out to avenge the death. Mm-hmm. Yeah, avenge the death of his brother.
Well, this count as a deconstructionist Western because it is very much a dark revenge story. Like this is a story about. Well, you know what? I don't think it's revenge. I think it's vengeance. I think it's whatever the thin line there is between them. But he is acting as an instrument of a larger power here, smiting people maybe. I mean, this all assumes that is supposed to just straight up believe he's some sort of supernatural figure. I kind of think that we do, actually. But
It starts out at the very beginning of the movie. It starts out he sort of materializes from nowhere.
Yeah.
And we get that weird soundtrack.
It's like a theremin or something, or The Shining. It's like the opening of The Shining is what that music sounds like. Yeah. It's just like the heat scorch coming off the desert, and he sort of materializes out of thin air.
And returns to it at the end of the movie.
Yeah, and he just rides back into it at the end.
And disappears. You can actually watch him disappear.
So cool. So cool. That is, I mean, it's tipping you off right there. I mean, I feel like he's at the beginning, he's playing with the idea of, like a guy coming in, coming into town out of nowhere, just a drifter,
Right.
breezing
High
into town.
Plains
He's not a
drifter, as a matter
drifter
of
though.
fact.
He's actually got a very distinct purpose.
Agenda.
Yeah, and like he's
Yep.
there for a very specific reason. But yeah, it's a play on that that conceit. And the whole movie is a play on a familiar Western conceit, which is a town is threatened by bad men and banditos or whatever, and they hire somebody to protect them. Like they hire a gunslinger to come in and stop the bad guys from coming in and killing the town. And that's the plot of High Plains Drifter, really. It's just
Right.
it's just a massive subversion of that.
One thing I missed when I watched this earlier is that they'd already hired three guys to deal with interlopers,
Yeah.
right? The town had already hired three guys to do that job, right? And those are the three guys that Clint kills in the first sequence.
Yeah, the first thing he does is when he comes into town, he's kill the three guys hired to protect the town. And I mean, it's a bit it's provocated. They kind of threaten him, but he ends it pretty good.
Oh,
he
yeah.
shoots them all in about 5 seconds. And well, I mean, first off, he comes into a bar and they hassle him a little, and then he just sort of wanders off and goes to get a shave. And they follow him into the barber, and that's the point when he's just like, "Oh, okay, I
Yep.
guess I'll shoot all three of you." He's got a great line in there. There's a lot of incredible lines in this film, by the way. The dialogue is just wonderful in High Plains
Yep.
Drifter. More badass Clint Eastwood lines than any other film I can think of. He is known for those. What is it he says at this point?
Wonder what took us so long to get mad.
You think you're fast enough to hang with us or something like that? And he says,
Oh, yeah.
"A lot faster than you'll ever live to be." Ooh.
Yeah.
Ooh. He looks like an undertaker riding into town too. His look in this film is impeccable. This is such a good. Is this big, long black duster? He's so thin and tall. It just looks like a he looks like a caricature drawing of a demon cowboy, basically.
Picture a demon cowboy, there he is.
The midget in town. Excuse me, the dwarf. Mordecai.
He actually is a midget. Yeah.
Interesting actor. I wasn't super familiar with him, but I feel like I've seen him in some stuff of the period.
He'd been in business for years doing
What
stuff.
was his name? I don't remember his name.
Billy Curtis.
Billy Curtis. I can't name a thing he's been in, but he's definitely familiar. He's an interesting character in this. What is his role in the town, do you think? He's sort of the guy who starts fawning over Eastwood immediately. And there's I feel like there's a
He's
couple
the
ways to take that.
underdog of the town. And therefore, the guy that Eastwood is going to pick to be the sheriff and the mayor. Because part of this demon cowboy's plan of vengeance is to humiliate the townspeople.
Well, that's what it is. I mean, that's the film, I think, ultimately, where it is. I mean, yeah, he definitely wants revenge on some specific murderers, but most of the action of this film is denigrating and destroying emotionally, or just ripping the lives of these people apart and kind of exposing their hypocrisy and thrusting it back in their face, like
And their guilt.
and their cowardice. He's an agent of vengeance, but not just for his killers. It's for everyone. It's for everyone, and there's reasons for that
Yep.
too.
Right.
But that's most of the action of the film, exposing why the lies that everyone tells, like the sheriff, The sheriff strikes up a, you know, almost a cordial relationship with him at first. And, you know, Eastwood allows that to continue until the point where he just says, "Yeah, you're a piece of shit sheriff." Takes his badge off and pins it right on Mordecai. And same with the mayor. And these guys are all just sort of, everyone's just terrified of him. Like, this is a familiar scene in Eastwood movies where he's just terrifying to everybody around him. And I love that the use of him in this film as sort of a demonic character, as sort of a ghost or an angel or whatever he is, like, that it's, since we're not specifically on his side, that stuff is more unsettling, you know? Those moments when he turns on somebody on a dime.
Well, are we or are we not on his side? Because
we're on his side because he's Clint Eastwood.
Yeah,
but he's also
Clint Eastwood.
You know, he's also monstrous. Because of something that happens very early on, by the way, which I wasn't able to get over. The scene where he drags a woman to a barn and rapes her.
Right.
Yeah, that happens 12 minutes into this film. It's. What are we to make of that?
She egged him on.
She egged him on. Yeah, that's the weirdest messed up thing. Like, there is... boy. On the one hand, I want this to be an acknowledgement that this guy is dangerous and frightening and potentially quite evil. But there's this creepy 70s she egged him on kind of quality to it as well, like that part of his vengeance is to shame her, to you know, by raping her because she is a sexually forward woman who has sex with a lot of people, and
she's a liar.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I'd call that rape.
No, but I mean, she lies about later on in the movie, she lies about whether or not she... remember when the bad guys come into town and she says, "Take me with you." You know, I was always... Mm-hmm. I was always yours.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Trying to save her own skin.
She attaches herself to people that are powerful using sex. Like, it's... And it's, you know, that is her sin. Everyone in town's got their sin, you know.
Right.
Except Verna Bloom, I guess. But
and Mordecai,
yeah. And so I guess that the rape is divine punishment. Is that what we're going with here? It's messed up. It's really messed up. It's, I don't know what to make of that. I'm okay with thinking of it as an indication that this character is a bad guy, or at least has some evil.
That's what I was just going to say. It's establishing the character as a
Dirty Harry doesn't rape people.
No.
You know.
No, but it establishes the character as not necessarily a good guy.
To say the least. Know? Yes.
if not to say, you know, a total, but the thing is, you're always on his side, you know, and you know he's there for a reason.
I find him frightening in this movie. He's a force of nature. I mean, I've been saying versions of that this whole time. I'm on his side because he's Clint Eastwood and no one else has charisma, and again, you know he's not going to die. Like, if there was ever a film where there was no chance of this guy, like, dying, even if he appeared to die, I wouldn't believe he was dead. You know, like, this character exists beyond that. So I don't know. I almost feel like it's not a side I'm on. It's just a witness to a force of like a hurricane coming in here, you know, or something like that. Because I'm not rooting for him exactly. I mean, especially when his whole move is, you know, to shame everyone and destroy everyone and just rip the place asunder and, you know, and lower everyone. I mean, that is his goal.
Yeah, but they all deserve it.
They all deserve it in sort of a in the sense of like moral Old Testament law, you know, like in a sort of biblical
eye.
Sodom and Gomorrah kind of sense. Like, on the other hand, you know, what were, you know, I don't know that what they were going to go like. Well, okay, the original sin here is that the town sheriff was killed. He was whipped to death in the middle of the city center, you know, right in the streets. And everyone saw it. No one did anything. And that I'm not sure what they were supposed to do. I mean, shoot him.
And
I
there
guess.
Was a reason. There was a reason for that.
It gets more complicated. Yeah.
There was a reason nobody helped him.
More Tales from the Crypt. In sort of in its mode here. You know, like everyone is guilty. Everyone is guilty because what happened is this is the town is Lago. It is a mining town. Out on the, you know, out, it's on this dead lake. It's a really impressive location. Mono Lake, I believe, is the name of the...
Mono Lake.
Uh-huh. Is it Northern California? Is that right?
Yeah, somewhere in the Sierras.
Ever been there?
Nope.
All right, well, it looks very Northern California. Sort of desolate Northern California. But anyway, the town of Lago... their mining operation basically runs the town, and they discovered that the town actually, according to old-time land rights, belongs to the government. So the entire operation was illegal, and the sheriff...
It was the marshal. The marshal discovered that it... Yeah.
The marshal, yeah. The marshal discovered this and was going to expose it, was going to tell the state that, you know, what was going on. And so they let him be killed, and maybe directed those guys towards him. It's not entirely clear, but they all had a share of the guilt here, and they covered it up. And
right,
mm-hmm, all the city fathers, but everyone knew. This is a town of
25
people.
buried him in an unnamed grave,
yeah,
unmarked grave.
Yeah, very important. And they all carry that guilt with him everywhere in proper Catholic fashion, and.
You know what's very cool about that, about the marshal, the story of the marshal? The first flashback is in Eastwood's mind. He wasn't there.
Yeah.
Or was he?
Yeah, uh-huh.
You know?
That's an interesting conceit in this film. Like, the way that we see these flashbacks of this guy getting whipped to death is like Eastwood has dreams or visions of them. And
well, he has one and Mordecai has another.
Well, Mordecai is a flashback. He's like remembering it, I believe. Like,
right.
They all remember right. it, you know.
Right.
But when Eastwood sees that, yeah. Like, well, first off, I thought that the actor getting whipped to death was Clint Eastwood. It's not. It is actually his body double.
Oh,
it's kind of
really?
Cool, huh? Yeah.
Yeah.
If it actually is Eastwood, then it's a little less mysterious, but yeah, it was a guy who looks very much like Clint Eastwood, and I think that's a great conceit.
yeah.
But if he's getting those visions, then yeah, he was there or he's being directed. One of the two, like that requires a supernatural explanation.
Yeah.
Unless he was just hiding in town, no one knew it. But that's not what happened. And, yeah, it's, I mean, he curses them as he's getting whipped to death, doesn't he? Doesn't he say, like, God damn you
damn
all?
It, damn yeah. you all to hell.
Yeah, uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then there's, you know, this is the film now. This is him, they realize he's killed the guys that are supposed to protect them from some dudes getting released from jail. This is the what are these guys named? Tracy something? Stacy,
yeah.
Jim Stacy or I don't know. It's a guy named Stacy and the Carlin brothers, who they whipped him to death, and then the town framed them for something involving stealing ingots.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they've been in jail. They just got released from jail. So the town needs protection. Mm-hmm. There's that jackhammer, by the way. Can you hear that?
Not too much.
Well, I'm sure our podcast listeners will be able to. I'm really sorry, everybody. It's been like this all week. It's like one. I'm furious about it. let's see. Oh God, there's this another scene with this girl. Oh God, where she shows up at the I believe the bar where they're all at, and she tries to shoot Clint Eastwood.
Oh, he's in the bath.
Yes, he's in the bath, and she shows up and with a gun and tries to kill him.
Right.
And it's sort of, she gets grabbed and taken off, and Clint Eastwood's just sort of like, I wonder what took her so long to get mad.
Yeah, right.
And this goddamn dwarf, he says, well, maybe because you didn't go back for more. Ooh, creepy. Like...
Yep.
I always
wondered how she could possibly miss him.
Yeah.
She's like 5 feet away.
Well, because he's Clint Eastwood. Maybe she hit him. Maybe she hit him and he's a demon. You know? Mm-hmm. So the town offers Clint everything he wants, basically. Anything he wants. As long as, he stands and protects them from these guys. And basically gives him free rein to, take anything from the shop, any drinks, everything's free on the house. And he abuses this power immediately and often. wandering around the town, taking boots and blankets and stuff. Messing with everybody, basically. Shaming everyone as the cowards they are along the way. What's up with this scene with the Indian, by the way? Where there's a Native American guy in town.
Checking out the blankets in the store, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh. And
where did the Indian come from?
he's not there for the rest of the movie. I suppose he's just passing by. Him and his kid.
Right.
And the shopkeeper is just being super racist. And he's like, we don't want your kind. Yeah, get out of here. You go get
keep
dirt
your,
on him.
Keep your sticky fingers off of those blankets.
Yeah, uh-huh. Now, what are we to make of Clint Eastwood doing this good guy move here? It's like, oh, well, I'll take the blankets and then give them to that Indian fella. How about that? And like... That's like the closest he gets to an altruistic move. I guess it's just to shame the shopkeeper, though, right? But the entire point is just like, hey, you know what? Look at this. I'll point out how you're an asshole.
I think that's true. He does the same thing. It's somewhat, I wouldn't call it altruistic, but he makes sort of a good guy move when he makes Mordecai the sheriff.
Mm-hmm. Is it a good guy move, or is he just like, I'm gonna take this clown that you all hate and elevate him above
shaming,
you.
Shaming the townspeople again.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I mean, he seems to be cool with Mordecai. He's sort of like his little, his Disney sidekick, I guess.
Yeah.
You call it.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Like he's Iago the parrot to Clint Eastwood. he's just kind of like his little go-to guy. He's like, and makes him the mayor and the sheriff. And this is all part of a systematic messing with everyone kind of thing, shaming them. And by the way, while he's doing all this stuff, he's also like ostensibly teaching them to be braver.
Training them to defend themselves.
He's teaching them courage, and and how to stand up together as a town.
They don't quite get it though, do they?
No, they're bad at it. They're actually
they're
quite
really
bad.
Bad.
Uh-huh. What it's during that he's got the line to that one guy he says, "You're gonna look awful silly with that knife sticking up your ass." That's a good line.
And then the same guy just keeps standing there, and Clint Eastwood says, "What, are you still here?"
Mm-hmm.
And he says, no, I guess I'm not. And moves off.
Yeah. So, you know, they're starting to have enough. They're kind of done with this guy. They're wondering if they really need him, you know. Like, maybe we can screw him over or kill him or something, you know, because they're bad guys. And the weight of their guilt hangs upon them. You know, the woman that Clint Eastwood raped, you know, her beau is kind of sexually jealous of Clint Eastwood. Another messed up part of that storyline.
Right.
And this is kind of the scenes where it comes out that they're all tainted with sin and they're all guilty of the sheriff's death. I believe the who's that guy, the big Josh Brolin looking guy who seems like the
big mustache?
Yeah, one of the more moral ones of them, I guess.
I can't remember.
One who feels a little worse about things. He has the line, "If one hangs, we all hang," which, you know,
yep.
Probably not quite true, but that's where they are emotionally.
Yeah.
You know, even the preacher is kind of, you know, complicit in all of this. Kind of. Yeah, Clint clears out the hotel. He kicks everyone out of the hotel who's staying there because he's got free reign. And, you know, the preacher comes and asks him to, you know, reconsider, calls him his brother. And I thought this line was interesting where he's like, "I'm not your brother," which, you know, you can take as just being a badass, or maybe he's not human.
Oh, and then he says, "What about all these people here? Are they your brothers and sisters?"
Yeah.
He says, "Yes, they are." He says, "Well, I'm sure you wouldn't mind making room for them at your place then."
Mm-hmm. Which he does for the same rate they're paying at the hotel. Yeah,
that's right.
Is this the point where he starts kind of creeping on Verna Bloom here? The hotelier's wife. It's kind of the older actress. What's her name? Yeah, Verna Bloom.
I forget the character's name.
But she's everyone in this is sort of just a symbolic representation rather than a character. I feel like, you know.
Yeah.
It's such an allegory that, you know, the character names almost, they never get mentioned for the most part, and they're largely irrelevant to the large, you know, to everything.
That's why we don't remember them.
Yeah, We just don't remember them. They're never said, and they're not important. This is the sheriff. This is the hotel. Yay. This is the, you know, this is the preacher. And, you know, and Eastwood is the stranger. He's way into Verna Bloom, and everyone's into him. He's, you know, all the women really, really find him quite charismatic. He's got a huge libido for a demon ghost. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And she's the only one who kind of talks to him. He likes her and Mordecai, I guess. And he doesn't have a lot to say, but she challenges him.
She enters the picture after that small group of townspeople try to ambush him in the hotel room.
Yeah. Well, that's when, he's...
he's been in bed. He's been in bed with the tramp.
With the woman he raped, yes.
Uh-huh. The woman he raped.
Who is, who I guess is into it now. She was kind of into it at the time. God, this movie. But, no, she's actually just there to kind of distract him while the murderers show up.
Right.
I guess she's working for them. I mean, she certainly gloms onto them once she sees what's up. Whether she knew in advance. Anyway, he knew in advance, too, and he hides behind a boudoir and drops a stick of dynamite in the middle of the room and blows it up and burns a big chunk of the hotel down.
Yep.
Kills a few of them, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kills most of them, as a matter of fact. One of them escapes. The guy got shot in the arm.
Yeah. And this leads, of course, to Verna Bloom, you know, telling him, well, the hotel's blown up, so I don't know where you're going to sleep now. There's only our room left.
Which brings a smile to Clint Eastwood's lips.
Yeah, and she's horrified because she thinks, oh, he's going to rape me now. He drags her into the room, and she pulls a knife on him to protect herself. Scissors, yes. And Clint manages to turn this into a sexy time.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yep.
The sexual politics of this film are suspect, I have to admit. They're a little off by modern standards. I think it kind of works because it's such a weird biblical, like, Old Testament allegory, but, you know, it's still, yeah. Like, you watch it now, and I was just like, gah! And in a way, I think that creepiness adds to the film, though. Because this is a creepy film going for creepy. Yeah. And yeah, so Verna Bloom falls in love with him.
She's attached to him, sort of, yeah.
Well, she's in a terrible marriage. She and her husband hate each other, and she's under his thumb, and he's a jerk, and so they're, you know, there's already tension there. I believe this is the point where Clint Eastwood forces everyone to paint the entire town red and renames it Hell.
Yes.
I loved it.
And has some of the Mexican workers dismantle a barn to make some picnic tables.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he sets up a feast for the Stacy and the Carlin brothers. Like,
welcome home, boys.
A welcome party for them, and there'll be a feast, and you have to order all sorts of expensive food. And we're also going to paint the town so it looks like hell. I get why they're trying to kill him. I get why, that's not a far bridge for these people at this point. So they literally paint this town bright red, like barn red, you know, and it's a wonderful set. This is like a dilapidated junk town, you know. It's like we said, there's like 25 people living here. It's right on the bank of this dead lake, you know, on a plain, and these bright wood edifices, you know, which apparently, this is really interesting, they built the whole set
Right.
For location.
They didn't want to use sound stages.
No sound stages in the film. Everything is, there's probably a few, but every building is functional, and so they could shoot inside. So the whole thing is as you see it. And it has a tactile quality to it for sure, especially when it's painted bright red and looks completely unreal. Like it's a striking image to see an entire town that is just red. Like, you know, to see these, to see shots, like familiar Western shots of, you know, Clint Eastwood walking down the middle of the, you know, of a city street, but all the buildings that look, you know, like cartoon backdrops or something, except they're clearly not. It's striking. The end of this movie, the last third, I would say, is a deeply striking film. Like, when there's fire and it's night and there's a shootout in this red town, it's gorgeous. Mm-hmm. They look like Monopoly hotels, is what I wrote in my notes. And it's just a surreal nightmare. God.
Speaking of the nightmare, well, we'll talk about it when we get to it, I guess. But the fire in the background while Clint Eastwood is whipping that guy.
Are we literally in hell at the end of this?
That's what I was going to bring up.
Yeah.
Well,
okay.
if we're not in hell, then we're with somebody who has been sent from there.
Yeah. I mean, it's a hell on earth situation at the least.
Right.
Like, he has brought a piece of the inferno up into our world, or brought a part of our world down to there. It's, you know, like the end of this film. It, you know, we're in the pit. You know, this is leaping out of the ground, you know, and all the light appears to be coming from these fires. It's visually stunning, you know?
Yep.
And this is something that's great. They're getting ready for the gang to arrive, and I believe Mordecai knows. Who is it says that? Well, what do we do after? Because they're all still worried he's going to kill him after that.
That's Mordecai, yeah.
Yeah, he's just like, well, then you live with it.
Yep.
So, the Stacy gang shows up. And by the way, I think the Stacy gang should have had, like, you know, six people in it or maybe more. Three's too few.
Yeah, you can handle three, no problem.
They could. They couldn't handle six or seven. But three, I think they could handle three. These people are not above, you know, they already just tried to kill Clint. A bit of a cowardly way, but they could all just stand in the buildings with guns, and as soon as these guys ride into town, they could kill them. And they don't, even though they've been training for it.
Because they're crappy.
They're cowards, yeah.
They don't know how to shoot. Yeah, they're cowards, and they don't know how to shoot.
Yeah, but you put them in a crossfire. You get a shooting
galley.
They
shoot each other.
You know? Yeah, yeah. You definitely get those guys. So they ride into town, and Clint has just disappeared. Clint's just gone. He just bounced. And yeah, they mess everybody up. They beat everyone.
They shoot a few. They shoot the mustache guy.
Josh Brolin goes down. Yeah.
Yeah, he goes down into the lake.
Mm-hmm. And so yeah, clearly three were enough. Yeah. Just looking at my notes here, and they're all like, this rape victim is a horrible character. Just sexually manipulative and dumb and maybe nuts. And just like, yeah. This is the point where she's like, oh, I was always on your side, Stacy. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah, yep. Just trying to sell everyone out. Oh, God. So they hang out and just like live it up for, you know, half a day into the night. You know, basically act like mad kings in this town, and then when it gets to be night, that's when Clint comes back. And
And they've herded all the townspeople into the bar.
Uh huh. Yeah.
Right.
Mm hmm.
So they can further wreak their vengeance. Talk about wreaking vengeance. They're wreaking vengeance for what the townspeople did to them.
Yeah.
By falsely accusing them of something.
Yeah,
sending them to prison.
Stealing ingots. Yeah, they're
stealing ingots.
These town people, they suck. They're no good at all. They're real bad guys. in classic like Tales from the Crypt fashion, these are just, you know, they are guilty and sinful and need to be
exterminated.
He leaves most of them alive.
Humiliated first.
Purged, would you say? You know,
the town needs to be purged.
What's the word? Purified, maybe. Sort of like an Inquisition would do.
Yeah.
Anyway, so they're in the town, and one of them has their back to the tavern. They're in the tavern, and one of them has their back to the saloon doors, and just a whip comes out of the night and grabs him, pulls him out by the neck. So good.
And that's the scene I was talking about. When he starts whipping him, all you see is the fire in the background.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And him standing there with the whip.
Yeah. Uh-huh. It's definitely all the powers of hell kind of moment.
Yep.
He's also doing some impossible geography in this scene. Like, he's above them, he's far away from them, he's all over the place. Kind of jumping around. We don't, you know, we're following the gang. You know, we're following the Carlin brothers and Stacy and not him. So he's sort of a Jason figure, you know, like a... You know, he's in the dark somewhere, and they can't find him, and they don't know where he's going to pop out from. He kills one guy, Phantom of the Opera style, he drops a noose around his neck and yanks him up. Like,
was it a noose or a whip?
It was a whip, of course. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's all whips. Yeah. Uh huh. Because that's how they killed the old town marshal. And
right.
Yeah. And even as Stacy, this is an actor, by the way. Guy playing Stacy, he's in a lot of Clint Eastwood movies.
Oh yeah, what's his name?
Jeffrey Lewis, I think.
He's in a lot of Eastwood movies. Yeah.
Yeah, he's got that face. He's very much a character actor. He's
Lewis.
A bunch
Lewis.
Jeffrey Lewis. He's usually plays characters along these lines, I would say. Yep. I always wondered what, you know, why he keeps using him. I wonder if they're friends or something, him and Clint. Anyway.
Probably gets a little... Well, he did have kind of a stable of actors and actresses for
yeah.
a while.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know?
And as Stacy is
Sandra
getting
Locke
killed...
Days.
As oh, well, Sandra Locke, yeah. as Stacy is getting killed, he's just screaming, "Who are you? Who are you?" Never finds out.
Never finds out. Mm-hmm. It drills him 3 times in the chest.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Then the hotelier comes out, tries to take down Eastwood, and Mordecai kills him.
All right, Mordecai.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
That's the thing. We mm-hmm. want somebody to save Eastwood.
He doesn't need saving. That's my contention. Like,
no, but when it happens, Mordecai saves him, right?
He prevents him from being shot.
He
prevents him from being shot. Look, there's no one in this is sympathetic. I mean, Eastwood is clearly the charismatic movie star in it. So, I mean, clearly he's the protagonist and he's the guy who we're rooting for. And because it's a badass Western about, you know, and he's an unbelievable badass in this. Like, he is the protagonist figure, sure. But, you know, still.
Yeah.
Verna Bloom, free of the hotelier now. Appears to be leaving town. and we get to the final scene in the movie.
Last two lines.
Oh, God. Well,
last two lines. Mordecai.
It's significant before then, I think. That
okay.
They're in the graveyard.
That's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, the route that Eastwood came into town, and now the route that he's leaving, and Mordecai is putting up a tombstone.
He's carving on an existing tombstone.
Oh, is that what it was?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
I thought he put it up, and because it was an unmarked grave. But either way, it was unmarked.
Right.
And, and yeah, as he's leaving.
So, as he's leaving, Mordecai mm-hmm. says, "You know, I really don't know your name." And he turns to him and he says, "Yeah, you do." And then it pans to the gravestone.
Yeah.
With the uh-huh. name Jim Duncan, Marshall Jim Duncan on it.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
So, what do you think happened? What do you think that says?
I think it says very clearly that he is a ghost from hell.
The ghost of Jim Duncan?
Well, okay, he's a supernatural figure no matter what. I mean, I think that my mind was completely made up already. But
right.
But, like, clearly this character is acting as a tool of vengeance, whether that's divine, you know, in a real Old Testament kind of way, as in, you know, like Noah.
Eye for an eye.
Like, you know, I will wipe Sodom and Gomorrah from the earth, kind of like, you know, the vengeful wrath of an almighty, unknowable God. Maybe it's that. Maybe it's the actual ghost, the literal ghost of Marshall Duncan here, you know, that has taken on a different form and a different face to come get his revenge. Yeah, and... Or maybe it's something from hell. Maybe it's literally a demon of some kind come to collect souls on Earth. One of them. Or some combination therein. I think it's intentionally not explicit. But there's no question
I
in my
think
mind
he's,
that he's
I
something.
Think he's some kind of demon
mm-hmm.
that is possibly sent from hell, but in
in the service of divine law.
You get retribution for mm-hmm. the death of Marshall Dillon.
Uh-huh.
Interesting. Marshall Duncan.
By calling sins due. I mean, that's why I say collecting souls. Like, that's sort of a thing, you know, like, you know, the devil comes to claim his due. Or, I don't know, Tales from the Crypt was the touchstone I thought of, you know, which is that, you familiar with Tales from the Crypt at all, Dad?
Yeah, I saw a few way back when.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I was way into it when I was a kid because they were reprinting the comic books and everything, and it was sort of,
you know.
I remember
that. Yeah.
It was a close kind of, it was close to an R-rated thing that I could watch on TV, you know, so I was all over it. And, yeah, it had like a real teenage boy sense of humor, too. But the familiar thing about all those is, you know, that the protagonist is, you know, a bad guy who is in some way, you know, visited vengeance or justice for his wrongdoing, you know. And it's just variations on that over and over again. And so that's what this reminded me of. It was like equal parts Clint Eastwood deconstructionist Western and Tales from the Crypt horror story. I can't tell you how much I love this. Man, I'm a fan of this film. I think this is a great one. I've enjoyed chatting about this one, too.
this is great.
Mm-hmm. It works for me as a Halloween film for sure. I was thinking,
you know,
like,
the first time. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, please.
I was just going to say the first time I saw this movie when that the ending comes.
Yeah. What do you think?
I'm thinking. The first time I saw it, I thought, okay, this is Jim Duncan's brother or something.
Interesting. You would say that.
Come for vengeance.
Okay, that was a line that was cut from the film.
Really?
Yeah. There was I think it was an implied kind of notion that Marshall Duncan had a brother, and Eastwood decided he didn't want that in there. Apparently, it appears in some foreign markets, apparently, according to Wikipedia.
No kidding.
Yes.
No kidding.
But that was always an idea.
Which totally takes the supernatural character out of the movie.
It does, unless it's sort of just like, well, maybe it's his brother. I heard he had a brother. You know, it depends how it's laid out, you know. Yeah. If Eastwood flat out says he was my brother, yeah, it does. But but yeah, that is a. It's interesting that you came upon that because that was it, the film is structured in a way where that could also be true. They just kind of took that out.
Yeah, but there must have been a reason for that.
Well, the reason was Eastwood wanted it to have a supernatural gravitas.
Well, he did.
Yeah. To say the least. I love this. I love this film. I think this is gross sexual politics aside, I think it's one of Eastwood's best movies, and I really liked watching it, and I was really surprised how much of a horror film it was, and how ideal it was for us to do as an October horror movie. I'm giving it 4.5 stars.
That's what I was going to say.
I love it.
4.5.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yep. Why not 5?
Why not 5? I don't know. 5 just feels like, you know, I don't want to, you know, I feel like that's rare air. You know, I don't want to dilute a 5 because this doesn't have the emotional hit for me that something like, you know, that Deadwood had or, you know.
Unforgiven, maybe.
Unforgiven is a definite 5. I would say this is, I don't know. This and Josie Wales are both great. Maybe I got to revisit more of these old ones. I'm sure we will, but... I mean, I'm hard pressed to come up with my second favorite Clint Eastwood Western at this point, but it's quite possibly High Plains Drifter right now. You know, there's some.
Well, they compare High Plains Drifter to Pale Rider.
Mm-hmm. And Pale Rider is the Shane riff, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. But the Man from Nowhere.
Of course.
The Stranger.
Oh, he's definitely playing with Man from Nowhere imagery more so than any of his films. I think this is.
Yep.
This is a flip side of the Leone character. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah. I mean, what he's done a lot, so and he's got a thing that works very well for him, clearly. So, you know, you see a lot of that. His Western characters tend to be outsized. Has he ever played like just a regular dude in a Western? Even heroically? I guess Hang 'Em High he's not a special guy in Hang 'Em High. He's a good hero character.
Yeah,
but he's, not,
he's a special know. Guy. Yeah, sure he is.
But
no, he is. He's mm-hmm. he's the best marshal, right?
Uh-huh. He hadn't played Jimmy Stewart roles, I guess, is what I'm thinking.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
No, you know, untouched good guy movies for Clint Eastwood.
Mm-hmm. He's ubermensch all the time.
He's got somebody, as long as it's a true Western. I mean, he played, what is it, Bronco Billy?
Yeah, that's like kind of a modern day kind of cowboy rodeo thing.
Your cowboy somewhere. Movie, yeah. Mm-hmm. He's,
I haven't seen that. We should watch that one of these days.
Band member.
Uh-huh.
And then...
what about Two Mules for Sister Sarah?
I should watch that again just to see if there's any real value to it because I never liked it.
We'll get to it one of these days. We got more Clint Eastwoods to do. Yeah, I don't see a reason why we wouldn't touch every Clint Eastwood Western at some point
on this show. We've still got Good, Bad, and the Ugly.
Absolutely. Kind of have that one in the holster.
Unforgiven.
Saving on that. Oh, well, that one I'm very much waiting on. We've been doing this 2 years. At some point, we'll get to Unforgiven.
Can you believe that? Almost 2 years now.
Almost 2 years, absolutely. Mm-hmm.
Wow.
Yeah, that's pretty cool, Dad. Congratulations, almost 2 years. This is our second Halloween month of releases. Yeah. I don't know, any further thoughts on High Plains Drifter? This is actually a fairly plot-light one with minimal characters. It's just all theme and allegory and, you know, so...
Yeah.
I feel like that's all you really need to talk about with this one. Anything else? I read a very interesting article... about the philosophy of it, how it was, it was something like that. I don't know. I think that's what it was called. The meaning of justice and retribution in Clint Eastwood's High Plains Drifter, something along those lines. It was talking about the place of moral law in the Western, which supersedes all others, supersedes the law of man, and is akin to God's will.
Wow.
How in the absence of organized law or enforceable organized law, you know, how there's minimal infrastructure in a proper Western, or at least in the outskirts, in the frontier, in the proper Wild West, how when you're telling a story in this place, everything bows down to moral law, and that is the compass that cinema organizes itself around when showing a Western. That was kind of the thesis of the article.
So they're talking about innate moral law?
Yes. Uh-huh. God's law, if you will. Though it doesn't necessarily have to be a religious thing, but a force in the universe that is morality and correct law, you know, and that and you can see that in movies where there is, this guy needs a killing. I mean, it's that kind of thing. You know,
right? yeah,
uh-huh. And I think High Plains Drifter would be it was an interesting film to use as a point counterpoint for that idea, because it's very much about a sort of the unseen laws of the universe and how the universe bends to enforce them. Yeah,
Interesting.
In a horror story kind of way, this is one of the more successful genre mashups I can think of, because it works very much as a Western and as a horror film, even if it's not a very scary one, but it has all the trappings of a Western, all the themes of religious dread and revenge and guilt and the afterlife.
Yeah,
just cooked into it thematically.
Well said.
I love this film. I can talk about it a bunch, but anyway, I think I'll just be saying the same stuff about hell pretty soon. Have you watched anything else of late, Dad? Any other movies recently?
You know, I've always wanted to see Barry Lyndon.
Ooh!
And it came,
okay!
And it came on, one of the movie channels that we get, and I had forgotten that it was a Stanley Kubrick film.
Oh, it's very much a Stanley Kubrick film. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And boy, the camera work in Barry Lyndon is really something.
Incredible looking movie,
it's,
to be
it's
sure.
It's just a beautiful, beautiful film.
Yeah.
And, you know, Ryan O'Neal isn't my favorite actor, but he, you know, he did a passable job.
Well, it seemed to me when I watched Barry Lyndon that he was hired because he wasn't especially charismatic, or, I mean, I guess he must have been if he's Ryan O'Neill, he's a movie star, but he's not a, I don't like him much either. But I feel like what Kubrick wanted there was just a dude who didn't have to be a hero, who didn't have to be anything. It was just like, this is one ordinary person's life. I think that's a...
And not, I wouldn't say like that didn't have to be, he wasn't
yes.
a hero.
Yeah. Very deliberately. And yeah, that's what I took that to be, that casting. Maybe that, I'm sure that's what Kubrick was going for. He was a smart guy in those ways, you know, like he knew how to cast people correctly.
It was a great film. I really enjoyed it, and it was long. I mean, long film.
Yeah, I do like that movie very much. It's not one I'm super eager to revisit most of the time, but I remember
it's a
being
time
struck
commitment.
By it. It's a good 3 hours, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And it is, you know, you feel it feels like a human life unfolding before
you.
But not in a precious way. It's just very, you know, very matter of fact about, like, yeah, this is who this guy was. I like the narration very much in that movie.
Michael Hordern did all the
Michael
narration.
Hordern.
Yeah.
I remember my favorite scene in that is the scene when he's in front of like a magister or something, or a representative of the queen, and he can't help but tell the guy his secret, or what is it exactly?
He sent to spy on the Chevalier.
Yes, there.
And he just can't go through with it.
He's just too in awe.
Pours his heart out to the guy. He tells him everything, and they become fast friends.
Right. Yeah.
Because they're both Irish.
Mm-hmm. That's a well communicated, if I recall, by the narration. But it's a very interesting movie. I'm glad you watched that, Dad. That's exciting.
Good film.
I've been watching Stephen King movies because it's October.
What'd you watch?
I went to a double feature at the movie theater last night. Well, first off, I've got something called MoviePass. Have you heard of this, Dad? This is amazing. This is a card that you buy online. It is a monthly fee, $10. $10. And it's free movies.
Wow.
It's free movies. You go in, you use your app, and you select the movie you want to see. You got to be 100 yards from the theater to do this, apparently, because they have sensors or whatever. And it senses the movie, and it clicks, okay, now your money is now your card is loaded with enough money to buy a ticket for that. You go, you use the card on the kiosk.
Wow.
$10 a month. It used to be $50, and then they were just like, you know what? 10. 10 for everybody. Because they wanted to boost sales or something like that. So I don't know if it's going to, like, go back up later or whatever, but right now it feels like I am just robbing these people blind. I mean, one movie is cost like almost twice that in New York. So,
right.
So jeez. Yeah, I'm really taking advantage of them. Maybe, and it even worked for this double feature I saw last night of The Dead Zone and Pet Sematary. Yeah, I recommend doing it. It's $10 a month. $10 a month. Yeah.
I haven't even heard of it.
Well, it's still in business.
Heard of it out here.
It's called MoviePass nationwide. I recommend it. It works at every theater in the New York, as far as I can tell.
Wow.
I mean, the only problem is you got to be 100 yards. So if it's something that's going to sell out, you know, you would have to plan accordingly, and, you know, it's a whole thing. But I rarely go to movies that are going to sell out, you know?
Yeah.
And if it's only $10 a month, whatever. Anyway, that's MoviePass. I saw The Dead Zone and Pet Sematary yesterday. Have you seen either of those, Dad?
The Dead Zone, Christopher Walken.
Yeah, that's a good one. That's terrific.
Yeah. Yeah, I saw The Dead Zone.
The better of the two. That's a wonderful movie. I didn't like it much when I was a kid. It's great. It's a really
I don't remember it that well, but I remember seeing it.
It's closer to the Shawshank Redemption edge of the Stephen King kind of story. Yeah. Although it's still kind of a horror story, but not certainly not monstery. It's a guy with ESP, you know. And he
senses it when he touches someone, right?
Yes, he touches somebody's hands, Christopher Walken, and he's able to, you know, see the future or the past or whatever, you know. He gets flashes of their life.
Right.
And it's a really powerful story about, like, kind of like the human loss that has accrued in a lifetime, you know, and the weight that has. This guy has more than most people do, you know. He's in a coma for 5 years. And he's just isolated by this this gift slash curse, you know. But all the people whose lives he interact with, are, you know, it's powerful. They're, you know, and there's some horror elements to it. There's a serial killer plot line and a real creepy one. And there's also a there's a political figure that he's super Donald Trumpy. And it's a really good movie. I strongly recommend The Dead Zone. It's a good Halloween film, as is High Plains Drifter. So I believe that that's more or less it, isn't it? I think we're good this week. I think we're good on High Plains Drifter, and we did it in good time. On the next episode, our second Halloween October Western, we'll be we haven't quite nailed that down yet. It will probably be Near Dark, although it seems like that might not be available on streaming options easily or readily. I'm going to double check that. That is a Catherine Bigelow, a Western from the 80s. It's sort of modern Western with vampires. Got Bill Paxton, and Lance Henriksen, a lot of good people in it. That's a lot of fun. I hope we get to watch that. If we don't, it is going to be something I'm very curious about, a film called Grim Prairie Tales, which is a an anthology horror movie that takes place on the West. And that has James Earl Jones and Brad Dourif. So, you know, we'll see. It's going to be one of them. And we'll be here in 2 weeks. So thank you for listening. I'm really sorry about the jackhammers. I'm going to do my best with them in post. Have a good one.
Adios, amigos.